Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, Jacksonville humanitarian and activist Eartha White.
One of the things that I admire the most about her is how she really lived with the people that that she was serving, and she thought of it as serving.
We'll discuss an historic hurricane that prevented an invasion of Spanish East Florida.
Prior to the hurricane on October 4, 1811, Juan José de Estrada, the interim Spanish governor of East Florida, had begun preparations for the expected invasion and anticipated multiple defections to the American side.
And we'll talk about Florida's involvement in the Civil War. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Reach out and touched somebody's hand. Make this world a better place if you can.
Eartha Mary Magdalene White made the world a better place for African Americans living in Jacksonville through education, civil rights activities, the establishment of health care services, and more. Eartha White was born in 1876 and was adopted by a woman named Clara White.
Clara White was, a former slave, and she had had a number of children who had died.
Tim Gilmore is author of the book In Search of Eartha White, Storehouse for the People.
During Eartha White's time, there was this myth that was told, that most people believed, that Clara White had her 13th baby, and that this baby was kind of prophesied, and that this baby would grow up to become a storehouse for the people. That was the phrase that was used, and that was Eartha White. The actual truth is that Eartha White was the daughter of a man named Guy Stockton, who was part of the well-known and wealthy Jacksonville Stockton family. In fact, the Stockton family would go on to develop neighborhoods in Jacksonville like Avondale, San Marco, and Ponte Vedra. She was the daughter of Guy Stockton and a Stockton family servant named Molly Chapman. And so Clara had lost a number of children, and she and her husband Lafayette adopted Eartha White, raised her as their own. And, Eartha White always had wonderful things to say about Clara and ended up naming the mission that she and Clara started together in 1904. She later called it the Clara White Mission.
Eartha White was born in a time of enforced racial segregation, but Jacksonville in the late 19th and early 20th centuries had an active, inspired, and relatively prosperous African-American community.
There were several different parts of town that were thriving Black neighborhoods, and probably the best-known one now was a neighborhood called La Villa. Most of it is gone now. There are a few buildings left. People just think of it as a part of downtown now. It was once its own city, had a mayor and alderman, it had started as a plantation. And by the turn of the 20th century, and especially into the next couple of decades, it became a thriving, dense, cultural place. West Ashley Street was full of theaters and musical venues, including a place called the Globe Theater that Eartha White borrowed money from other people because she was not allowed to borrow from the banks herself to use as the Clara White mission headquarters. But actually, it really all began in 1904 when Clara, Eartha's adopted mother, started a soup kitchen on Eagle Street, which is now part of First Street. And that was in a lesser known black neighborhood just north of La Villa called Hansentown.
Eartha White graduated from the Stanton School, an important institution in Jacksonville's black community. Tim Gilmore.
James Weldon Johnson, probably the most famous person ever born in Jacksonville, was a principal at Stanton at one time. It was there that he wrote, he and his brother, Lift Every Voice and Sing. In fact, Eartha White was part of an opera company, which is rather surprising. it was called the Oriental American Opera Company. And J. Rosamond Johnson, James Weldon Johnson's brother, was one of the people who ran it. But the old Stanton School was really one of the central, most prominent places, for Black Jacksonville in that time.
After graduating from the Stanton School, Eartha White attended the Conservatory of Music in New York City and had a brief career as a singer.
Sometimes it almost seems like there's nothing worthy that Eartha White didn't do. I mean, just the most incredibly full life she did. And it's actually one of the things that I find most interesting about that is, you know, people have made a lot of the fact that Eartha White never married. She would have married when she turned 20 to someone in Jacksonville named James Jordan, who actually died of tuberculosis while she was touring with the Oriental American Opera Company. And, after that, there seems never to have been a prospect of marriage that she considered seriously.
When she returned to Jacksonville, Eartha White started a series of initiatives to help the African American community, first working to build a new school and teaching.
She did so many things in this time period. It's just remarkable that one person could do all these things. She was hired to teach at a rural school outside Jacksonville. It's now within Jacksonville's consolidated city limits, but in a place called Bayard. And she was responsible for building curriculum and all sorts of things that you wouldn't necessarily normally think a teacher would have to do. But she also started businesses. She really was a strong product of Booker T. Washington's self-uplift ideas at this time. And, as she grew the mission, the way I've always kind of thought about it is she kind of married Booker T. Washington's ideas with FDR's ideas, and it became just the center of just every kind of activism and community education in the city. Really quite remarkable how many things she did and how many things were going on at the mission at the same time.
Following the success of the women's suffrage movement, Eartha White wanted to make sure that Black women were included. She also fought against voter suppression.
In 1920, when women got the right to vote with the 19th Amendment, she went door to door helping to register Black women to vote. And of course, so Black Americans could vote, but there were so many things in their way that Jim Crow laws had put up. But she went door to door, and she actually helped in this effort against a Ku Klux Klan intimidation parade that was held in Jacksonville. This is 1920, same time that similar parades were held around the state in Tampa and Orlando and other places. And of course, same time as the Ocoee massacre. So she helped the effort. She worked with the NAACP and actually James Weldon Johnson at this time to stand up to this Klan intimidation parade. On election day itself, she carried lemonade up and down election lines and she led people singing, old hymns and Lift Every Voice and Sing. So just incredible courage that I think is almost hard to fully imagine what that would have been like, that kind of courage.
The Clara White Mission still exists today and has evolved since its inception as a soup kitchen in 1904. Under Eartha White's leadership, the mission at various times included an orphanage, job training, prison ministries, and a variety of healthcare services. Although Eartha White was familiar with some famous people and received many accolades, she chose to live among the economically disadvantaged people that she served.
one of the things that I admire the most about her is how she really lived with the people that that she was serving, and she thought of it as serving, you know. She maintained a bedroom on the second floor of the Clara White Mission, which people can still visit. It's maintained as though Eartha White might come back, you know, at any moment. So she didn't separate herself from the people that she was always trying to help. To me, it's almost a kind of sacred space, you know, just to imagine this is where she was, and to look out the window and to think about, to try and imagine La Villa at all of these different stages of its history, even to know that, you know, these are the stairs that she fell down when she went to the hospital for the last time and passed away at the beginning of 1974. So it's really kind of a sacred space to me in a lot of ways.
Tim Gilmore is author of the book In Search of Eartha White, Storehouse for the People. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Floridians are all too familiar with hurricanes and the damage they can cause locally, but they don't always consider how hurricanes and their damage affect national, regional, and even international events. The devastating hurricane that struck St. Augustine in 1811 is a case in point.
Sherry Johnson, who authored a book titled Climate and Catastrophe in Cuba and the Atlantic World in the Age of Revolution, penned an earlier article for the Florida Historical Quarterly in 2005 titled The St. Augustine Hurricane of 1811, in which she examines the hurricane as an example of the role of natural disasters to influence political events. In this case, the geopolitical event was the expected invasion of Spanish East Florida by Georgia farmers under the leadership of General George Matthews. Prior to the hurricane on October 4, 1811, Juan José de Estrada, the interim Spanish governor of East Florida, had begun preparations for the expected invasion and anticipated multiple defections to the American side. Johnson credits Estrada's response to the October storm for the later support of the Spanish defense against the invasion. Disaster studies have identified certain commonalities that were present in the St. Augustine storm. Natural disasters have an immediate leveling effect that leads to an us-against-them mentality of solidarity. Furthermore, Johnson notes a strong causal relationship exists among the demands of the population, inadequate government response to the crisis, and political unrest. On one hand, if the community's needs were met, the reaction would be cooperation, gratitude, and strong feelings of loyalty to the existing regime. On the other hand, indifference and incompetence foster resentment, resistance, and/or revolt.
Connie, the early 19th century was a period of turmoil for the Spanish government and its empire. The response to the remote Florida outposts could be expected to be inadequate and result in outright rebellion or at least unwillingness to resist the American incursion.
Turmoil and chaos characterized the Spanish Empire, beginning with the loss of Florida to the British following the Seven Years' War in Europe or the French and Indian War in the British colonies, from 1763 to 1783 following the British victory, East Florida was under British control before its return to Spain at the end of the American Revolution. During the later European Peninsular War from 1807 to 1814, Napoleon Bonaparte deposed the Spanish king and installed his brother Joseph as monarch. In the resulting resistance, communications broke down between Spain and its colonies, and Florida, like other parts of Hispanic Caribbean, went through long periods without receiving payment of the cituado, leaving colonial areas in economic crisis and vulnerable to the promises of outside and invading forces. The aftermath of an intense and destructive hurricane, such as the one that hit St. Augustine in 1811, had the potential to further alienate local residents. However, Johnson argues that ties to Spanish rule were strengthened as policies for dealing with disasters that had been developed decades earlier operated to provide relief and assist in rebuilding. On the morning following landfall of the storm, Estrada was out in the community organizing neighborhood commissioners to gather information about individual losses. As their records demonstrated, the storm surge flooded the city, destroying homes, crops, businesses, boats, and tools for rebuilding and sustaining the community. Only 3 people lost their lives, but St. Augustine remained in peril as foodstuffs, ovens for baking bread, and carpenter and blacksmithing tools were lost to the floodwaters. The monetary loss was calculated at 65,000 pesos, ranging from individual losses of thousands of pesos to a modest claim of 8 pesos for the loss of used clothing. The immediate problem centered on providing residents with food, clothing, and shelter. Estrada called out all civilian and military men to assist survivors and aid in clearing the debris. He sent messages inland to assess the damage in surrounding towns and calculate their ability to provide supplies. Inland farmers provided shipments of food within days. They also provided palmetto thatch to repair roofs and provide protection from the elements. With no expectation of relief from Spain, Estrada called on the merchants of Fernandina to donate supplies for recovery. As Johnson notes, quote, although some degree of coercion was almost always imputed in government requests for voluntary donations, also implicit in the request was that those who stepped forward to help in times of trouble would expect some reward in the future. To no one's surprise, barely 3 weeks after the arrival of emergency supplies, Fernandina petitioned Estrada and Treasury official Manuel Lopez for a reduction in the amount paid to conduct business, end quote. In December, Estrada forwarded a package of letters and reports to Cuba to be sent on to Spain, outlining the destruction and the petitions for reimbursement or tax relief. Estrada carefully justified his actions, including his demands for relief from Fernandino's merchants. He closed his report with a comment on the character of East Florida residents. Quote, they are entirely ruined, but they have managed to survive with a great deal of patience, end quote. Johnson concludes, quote, one of the greatest enigmas of the Second Spanish period is the unwavering loyalty of the majority of the population. What could have been, indeed should have been, a total breakdown of civil and military society in Spanish Florida after the hurricane of 1811 did not happen. Conditions were ripe for rebellion if rebellion and independence from Spain really were desired by the residents. General Matthews' invasion force awaited across the St. Mary's River, and they could compare the general's promises with the recent actions of their Spanish governor. Even before the storm struck, Estrada had offered conciliatory measures to both Anglo settlers and Seminole tribes. In the aftermath of the hurricane, it was clear that emergency measures included everyone. No one was excluded from the responsibilities to help or from the sharing in the generosity of their neighbors. Neither rich nor poor nor invalids nor free people of color, women or children. Estrada's response continued the policies of previous decades, And in so doing, the positive governmental response sustained Spanish Floridians' feelings of community and loyalty to the empire, end quote. As Johnson demonstrates, as with other hurricanes across the centuries, the 1811 hurricane devastated a community but shaped national and international history.
Well, let's hope we avoid any history-making hurricanes or violent revolutions in the near future. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Our state was the third to secede from the Union, behind only South Carolina and Mississippi. Sebastian Garcia has more about Florida's involvement in the Civil War.
Emily Coughlin serves as a collections manager at the Orange County Regional History Center. Emily recently delivered a presentation at the History Center about Florida's involvement in the Civil War. Florida's fourth governor, Madison Stark Perry, played a critical role in the state's path to secession by reestablishing the state militia and urging a statewide election that led to a secession convention.
The convention was a big deal because that is where all of the delegates met. They had all been elected using kind of a senatorial system. It was two representatives per county or area. They were all sent to Tallahassee, and they voted 62-7 to adopt an ordinance of secession and formally withdraw from the Union. They met on January 3rd for the first time, and then by January 10th, they had adopted the ordinance of secession and decided to officially part from the Union.
The Confederate Army lost key areas in Florida throughout 1862, including places like Jacksonville and St. Augustine.
The Northern troops occupied Fernandina, and Confederates just could not get that back. Another big occupation was St. Augustine and Jacksonville were both occupied by Union troops. Jacksonville was occupied four different times. The Confederacy was able to kind of force them out a few times, and then the Union came back in, while St. Augustine fell and remained occupied by the Union until the end of the war. Confederates were never fully able to regain control there. And then in October of 1862, Union came in to the St. John's River right around Jacksonville, and they were able to actually force the Confederates back and force them to abandon their positions. The Union gained that area. The Confederacy lost that area. They were really just hurting at that point. Around 1862, 1863 was kind of when people were starting to realize that it might not go the way the Confederacy was hoping.
The well-known Battle of Gettysburg solidified the realization of a losing war for the Confederacy. Florida contributed heavily to this bloody contest.
Gettysburg, as we know, was the bloodiest battle of the Civil War. It happened in July of 1863 in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. There was a huge faction of Floridians fighting in Gettysburg. And there was a Florida brigade that marched into battle with 742 men. They lost 461 throughout the three-day battle. And just looking at statistics and percentages, they actually suffered the highest number of losses compared to any other Confederate brigade that was involved in the battle. But they were kind of heralded as heroic because they really tried to push back the Union, and they captured their cannons, and like they really made a dent in the Union forces at Gettysburg. But again, this was kind of the big turning point where they kept fighting, but this was really the beginning of the end for the Confederacy. If you go to Gettysburg, there is a monument to the Floridians that fought there.
Besides putting boots on the ground, Florida's salt works arguably signified the state's most significant contribution to the Confederacy during the Civil War.
The salt works in Florida were a big deal because obviously they didn't have refrigeration in the 1860s. So salt was how they preserved their food. And in Florida, they used the process of essentially removing the salt from salt water by boiling it. And these salt works were a huge portion of, again, giving the Confederacy salt so they could preserve their food so that people weren't dying of like preventable things because of rotten meat and things like that. The Union knew this, so their whole goal was to wipe out all of the salt works so that the Confederacy could not produce salt. They tried to burn down salt works, blow them up, all of that, and they just couldn't keep up because as soon as they would take out one, another one would be under construction. They were mostly up around Jacksonville, was where a lot of the big ones were. They just kept popping up south of Tallahassee. So up there was where most of them were. And then Tampa Bay and Cedar Key, there were a bunch of them. And that was where the Union really tried to take them out, and they just couldn't do it no matter how hard they tried. Florida was able to produce so much salt that it actually kept prices down for the salt shortages in Alabama, Florida, and Georgia, and was probably Florida's greatest contribution to the Confederacy as a whole.
Florida's cattle industry represented another unique contribution to the Confederate war effort, with individuals like Jacob Summerlin holding distinctions such as Chief Beef Quartermaster.
The cavalry was a band of soldiers, cowmen. They eventually formed the 1st Florida Special Cavalry Battalion, and the whole purpose of them was to protect the cows and the cattle drivers on the trails to the slaughterhouses in northern central Florida so that obviously this cattle could become meat for the Confederacy. Jacob Summerlin was a cowman. He was known as the cattle king in the area. He ended up being the chief beef quartermaster in the commissary department and was the primary Florida beef supplier to the Confederacy. And he was just a really successful businessman, and he was able to supply more than 25,000 cattle to be turned into meat for Confederate soldiers. The unfortunate thing with the cow cavalry for him was that the Confederacy originally promised him $8 to $10 per head, so per cow. They later reneged on the deal because they were losing the Civil War and couldn't pay, so he never saw the $200,000 that he had earned for all of his work. But it was kind of this band that started with ranchers, militia, and then actual Confederate soldiers that got together to escort drivers and cattle along the trails to keep the Union raiders away.
Shortly before Florida's surrender at the end of April 1865, the state's governor, John Milton, committed suicide, pledging death over reunion.
His final address, he said that death would be preferable to reunion. And he saw the writing on the wall, and he knew that the end was near and the Confederacy was not going to be the victor. So rather than deal with it, he completed suicide on April 1st, 1865, so that he wouldn't have to see the fall of the Confederacy and the reunification of the United States.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.